ZU on iTunes U. Mitnehmen zum Mitdenken.
Verbundkolloquium Mediatisierte Moderne mit Professor Sigmund Baumann zum Thema Caught Between Online and Offline.
I was rather plodding on the ground during my presentation today. It will be, as you probably gathered from the title of the speech, about living under interregnum. But I think that the notion of interregnum remains unpacking. In what sense I'm using it, I'm not referring to the interruption between the reigns of two different kings. Le roi est mort, vive le roi. I'm referring to a notion which was coined by a great Italian philosopher, Antonio Gramsci. But of course, starting from going back far away to the times of the ancient Rome, the first person who used the concept of interregnum was Titus Livius, historian of ancient Rome, speaking about the beginnings of the city, which, as you know, created empire, which lasted like no other empire in history for the whole 6 centuries. Titus Livius pointed out that the first legendary king of Rome was Romulus, and Romulus reigned in Rome for 37 years. 37 years were quite a long time, particularly at that period of history. 37 was about the average length of life of ordinary people at that time, which means that when Romulus died, there were very few people in Rome who remembered the world which did not contain Romulus. They came to understand, to assume, without much discussion, without any debate, that the whole instruction or briefing or recommendation or rule or pressure comes from one place. The place is called Romulus. I'm not referring to any palace because he changed palaces, but the person, one person was the source, was the root of all life wisdom, and the person able to draw the line between the proper and improper, relevant, irrelevant, and so on. Therefore, when he disappeared, and according to legend, he didn't die, he went straight to heaven, suddenly the world seemed empty, a sort of a collective orphanage. People didn't know what to do. They knew very well that with the disappearance of Romulus, the old laws which he established, the old recommendations which he gave, lose quite a lot of their authority and binding power. But they had no idea who will replace him and what he will do and what sort of laws he will establish. Now, to this uncertainty, situation of uncertainty, the feeling of being lost, of being abandoned, of being impotent, not knowing what to do, referred Antonio Gramsci, where he came with an updated version of interregnum in the form that interregnum is a period where the old ways of doing things don't work any longer, but the new ones haven't been yet designed and put in place. Now I am suggesting to you, ladies and gentlemen, that we live in such a period now, period of interregnum, and the one very disquieting, causing anxiety and anger, feature of uncertainty, is that under such situation, everything can happen, but nothing can be actually done with any degree of certainty. So it is really feeling of being abandoned and lost. The feeling, very widespread feeling today, ladies and gentlemen, is that There is virtually no established institution to which we can address our postulate. Postulates to do something real, realistic at the same time, about the new problems which arise today. We are confronting today quite unprecedented problems, and therefore, we don't have the experience of historical experience to which we could go back and advise the solutions. There are plenty of such problems, I will name but three, to which no existing institution of collective action is prepared to cope. First one is the inequality, social inequality, which goes out of control. I understand that your professor, Nico Ster, just produced a book about inequality. Inequality is not much yet spoken about, but it is growing daily problem, which can be illustrated by two off-cuff examples. One, in 1960, not so far ago, 70 years, it was all within my own unforgivably long life. 70 years ago, the highest salaries of people, of directors of big corporations, were 30 times bigger than the wages of the workers who work for them. The extent of inequality slowly but stable but steadily grew. But in 1970s there was an upheaval. Really, they started accelerating. Inequality started accelerating. Developed on exponential rate. By 2007, the relation between the top salaries and the average wages of the low-earning people was already 531 instead of 30, and it goes on increasing. The second figure, which I wanted to bring in this context, which is very, very thought arousing, is what has happened after the collapse of credit in 2007. There was some recovery in the United States of America, indeed. Some value was added to American wealth since then. A very great success, yes, indeed, very great success. The interesting point, however, that 90% of this extra added value in the United States of America was appropriated by 1% of American population. Now that roughly shows the pace, the speed with which inequality grows today. I said that, and I repeat that of all these problems of which with which we struggle today, inequality is relatively less spoken about for the time being. Harald Welzer, who lectured yesterday here, pointed out in his book on climate changes that in 21st century people will be dying, not because of ideological reasons like they did in the last century, but they will be dying simply because some people sit on some resources which some other people desire and have a lust for and want to appropriate. So we are facing new kinds of wars, well, new kinds of wars returning to very primitive times of hunting, gathering tribes. When the conflicts, the antagonism, the struggle, and the victims are all caused by current distribution of wealth rather than by any other more sophisticated reasons. The second great problem is problem of diasporization. Diasporization, it is not just the question of migration of people, mass migration of people. Migration of people are accompanied modern times since the very beginning. Modernity produces organically, endemically, indomitably produces redundant people who cannot be accommodated with an existing way of living. There are two factories of redundancy built into the very notion of modernity. One is order building. Whenever you project a new, better, improved order building, inevitably some people appear to be redundant, not fitting the new order, and have to be disposed of one way or another, eliminated. And the second factory of redundancy is economic progress, because economic progress means that we produce the same things, but with less cost and less labor, and therefore some ways of earning a living, of surviving, prove to be unable to compete with more advanced, with more efficient and more profitable ones. And that's exactly what is happening throughout history of modernity. The problem, however, is, ladies and gentlemen, that at the beginning of modern era, Europe was the only part of the globe modernizing, the only one producing massively redundant people. The peasant economy, pre-modern economy, didn't know the idea of rubbish, didn't know the idea of redundancy. Every person born had a place in the field, working, and around the table, family table. So the only Europe produced the excess of population. And that created a power differential that was ushered into the era of colonialism, era of imperialism. Europe conquered other continents without itself being conquered. Your grandfathers, great-grandfathers emigrated to America, South America, North America, to reconstitute their life, for which there was no place in little town and villages in Germany. And the same applies to Italy, and to Spain, and to Portugal, and to Holland, and virtually almost all of Europe, all including the Nordic countries. Migration changed direction in the post-colonial era, and now it comes our way. So people who, countries which late entered the route of modernization started, like we do, produce redundant people, and they in vain look places in which there is still bread and water, and one can dream of more or less decent life. The big difference, of course, that I don't have the armies which could conquer Europe and force us away from off the road and establish their own possessions, land possessions there. And therefore they are confronting themselves with local population, with the natives, but where they come. No side has, however, unlike in this period behind us, power to enforce the one thing which Europe, with mixed success, but tried to apply in 19th-20th century, when the migration, when the strangers were coming to our own countries, to European countries. That was the policy of assimilation. Assimilation idea is a metaphor. Well, we forgot about it because it was metaphorically used a long time ago. but it was metaphorically used. It came from biology. In biology, we speak about assimilation when you imbibe foreign substances, as you do three times a day or even more often, and transform these foreign substances into the cells of your own organism. They are becoming part of your own body, indistinguishably. Now, the policy of assimilation proclaimed, not achieved in practice, but proclaimed that whoever comes from outside and is strange and brings different culture, a different face, different way of being, different style, and so on, all that is a temporary irritant. It will go away. Our prospect is the prospect of uniformization, universalization of the ways of being human, and therefore the special art of living permanently with strangers is by definition unnecessary. What for? It's a temporary irritant. It is here today, but will go away very soon. Gottlob Ephraim Lessing, the great German originator of Enlightenment, one of the pioneers of Enlightenment, was probably the only one who dared to say that the differences between people is here to stay. The public, the dominant intellectual opinion was that the differences are historical accident, they will go away. The third great problem, which contributes to our feeling of being abandoned, impotent, unable to act effectively, and so on, which is characteristic of interregnum, is the question of unsustainability of the not so much even unsustainability of our planet, but unsustainability of our way of living, And particularly two aspects of this way of living, which we practice currently, and which we don't want to abandon. And idea that the solution to all social problems which successively emerge lies in one universal recipe. One universal recipe is economic growth. And the assumption that economic growth can go on indefinitely. Therefore, we don't need to look for alternative solutions. That is the recipe. The only problem which the powers that be need to care for is how to keep it going. The panic begins when the economic growth is coming down to zero, and the nightmare of our times is the negative economic growth, the monster notion, economic growth which is negative anyway. And the second aspect of our mode of life, which needs to be coped with because it is answered, it is virtually the question of survival, our collective survival, is our model of happiness, model of pursuit of happiness, model of dignified life, mode of successful life, a measurement of progress in individual achievement and things like that, all being identified with the rising consumption. So if you want to convince yourself that you are doing well in your life and those around you who look at you, that you are looking well, you are a successful person, then you have to show it in the style, in the quality, in the volume of your consumption. It's not just the only sin of what I call the consumerist syndrome, which rules in our kind of society, but one of the very important, because it erodes the shrinking resources of our planet as already has been calculated, we are consuming 1.5 planets continually. Consuming 1.5 planet in ordinary language means that we are consuming annually 50% more than the planet is able to deliver without grave consequences for the future. But there are some calculations who predict that already in 40 years' time from now, if this model of life continues, and if other countries, which are at lower living now, try to catch up with us, we will need 5 planets to satisfy the demand. Now the prospects of getting 4 more planets in the next 40 years are very slim, and therefore this issue is really tremendously grave. That's the situation. In very brief, crude abbreviation, simplification, in fact, I hope you will forgive me. Nico Stern gave me maximum 50 minutes to speak, so I have to confine myself. The question I would like to ask in this paper is, how did we come to this place? How did we come to this place? That we don't have political institutions which we can trust, that we don't have political established procedure which we can hope reasonably that they will bring the desirable results, and desperately looking for alternatives to them. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the cause of causes, the crucial event which happened in the last years, is the divorce between power and politics. And that's the trouble of our feeling of helplessness. By power, I mean the ability to have things done. By politics, I mean the ability to decide which things ought to be done. Particularly in the 30 glorious years after the Second World War, the general conviction, the general belief, I remember it from my own experience, was that both power and politics are securely united there. The wedding was made in heaven and no human power can actually separate them. Both power and politics reside in the same household called nation-state. Sovereign, territorial, nation-state, which has the power to have things done and the politics to decide to select which things ought to be done. Since then, situation changed. Under the influence of quite a number of developments, they have the family name of globalization. In short, very briefly, they consist in power evaporating from the level of the nation state into the cyberspace, or the space which the Spanish sociologist Manuel Castells calls the space of flows, while the politics remains exactly like in 19th and 20th century, local, confined to the nation state, to the boundaries of the nation state. No decisions taken within these boundaries have any binding force on the territories outside. So there is a discrepancy, institutional discrepancy built in our situation. And no wonder that when I was your age, people quarreled like we quarrel still, what is to be done. There were different opinions. Some people propose one thing, and other camps, political camps, propose something different. But they were all convinced that the only problem is to decide, really, to impose the solution to the question, what is to be done. Today, I suggest to you, the major question is not what is to be done. We probably will be more inclined to agree on values if we came together, sat around a round table and discuss it profoundly, the issue. But the big question is, who is going to do it? Look around, and even the most powerful governments of most powerful nation states are under double pressure, double bind. On the one hand, they try to satisfy the demand of their electorate, because the next elections are coming, they have to stay in power and so on. On the other hand, they must look nervously on the decisions expressed by so-called world investors. In other words, the ratings of the stock exchanges. Now, power, on the one hand, we have power which is emancipated, free from any political control. On the other hand, we have politics which is suffering constant deficit of power. Whatever it wants to do, it finds out that not enough power is in their hands to just do it. So that's for you the situation of interregnum. And the question which I repeat what I wanted to ask is how we came here. I will name three dates, which in my view are watersheds. Or rather, milestones on the road leading us to the place where we are now. The first date is 1492. Two things very important happened. Christopher Columbus discovered America, and King Philip and Queen Isabella in Spain decided to expel all Jewish population from Spain. Why I refer to these events as milestones? Milestone, discovery of America was a milestone because until then Europe considered itself not the ruler of the world, but rather an inferior power, in fear of the stronger ones, more developed, more civilized. On the one hand, there were the Caliphate or Ottoman Empire, China was by far excelling the wealth and the power of Europe at that time. And so-called discovering America was suddenly confrontation of Europe with a continent which, because of its differential of power, it could define as unpopulated, as no man's land. No man's land open for experimenting, remaking, reshaping, imposing new, completely different order, being deployed in order to satisfy one's own needs, and so on. It started the long centuries of colonization, but it started also the unending process of growing self-confidence of Europe in the ability to remake the world. First element, 1492. The second date, in fact two dates, 1555 and 1648. 1555, a very important event happened in Augsburg in Germany. The representatives of the ruling dynasties of Europe by that time devastated by the ongoing after Reformation war, post-Reformation war, religious wars, gathered in Augsburg in order to find solution to this warfare going on. The series of civil wars which allegedly destroyed 50% of German lands population at that time. Really devastating event in history. And after a long deliberation, people in Augsburg, gathered in Augsburg, came out with the formula cuius regio, eius religio. Cuius regio, eius religio. That means whoever is the ruler has all the right to decide in what God his subjects ought to believe. The first case like that, very distinct from the tradition of Roman Empire, which added all new local gods of conquered lands to the same pantheon, in spite of the fact that people who gathered in Augsburg considered themselves the heirs of the Holy Roman Empire. It didn't take ground immediately. this decision, Queen's Regio Avis Regio. It had to wait almost 100 years more. It achieved its culmination in 1648, when in two again German towns, in Osnabrück and Münster, representatives of ruling dynasties gathered, and they actually made this formula into a binding rule in Europe. Now, it's a curious formula. It's just a formula whose shadow we are still living to this very day. Cuius regio, eius regio. Imperceptibly, slowly, but steadily, was transformed in the modern period into the formula cuius regio eius natio. It actually was instrumental in creation of the modern nation state. Whoever rules, whoever has the majority in the times of democracy, in the times of election, has the right to decide the profile, cultural profile, the historical curriculum, binding national language or state language, and so on and so on. Without this formula, I suggest to you, it would be, in fact, difficult to imagine that how come to this fervor of nation building in 19th century and throughout a large part of the 20th century. That was the second date, second milestone on the road to which we are now. The principle of nation state, complete, absolute sovereignty over its territory. Still very much alive, even when the United Nations, the only global institution which we have at our disposal, was created. It was instructed, you can look into the statutes of the United Nations, to defend tooth and nail the unencroachable, indivisible sovereignty of every nation state. Every intervention from outside, legally, in international law, is considered to be, in fact, aggression. Aggression is something contemptible, which can't be tolerated. Well, the third date is 1755. 1755 was destruction of Lisbon. Destruction of Lisbon, of three natural catastrophes following one after another. First of all, there was an earthquake. The second came the fire, which destroyed whatever survived the earthquake. And after all that came what we today would call tsunami, which flooded the remnants of Lisbon and just swept away whatever was left there. Lisbon at that time was one of the major and deeply respected centers of European culture, intellectual life, European culture, also European trade, also European seafare, and in all respects, one of the prides of the gathering feeling of being a civilization, a most advanced civilization in the history of humanity. And that caused tremendous upheaval in the way people considered the relation of things. Francis Bacon, if you probably remember, pointed out already much earlier that in order to control nature, we need to study it, we need to know it. But he also added, that's what he meant, that knowing nature means obeying it. Hegel would say later, as you know, that freedom is the recognized necessity. So the idea of studying nature, idea of scientific research, idea of using the knowledge of the laws of nature for human benefit, it was not born in 1755. But what was born in 1755 was somewhat some reversal of this formula. It was no longer just using the knowledge of nature to human benefit, but it was the idea, very audacious idea, very courageous, but very arrogant at the same time, idea of taking the universe under human management. There was a long discussion between Voltaire and Rousseau, two pillars of French Enlightenment, about this topic. The major issue there was that the divine order left to us in the form of nature is far from perfect. It strikes blindly. It punishes everyone around, whether they are good people or wrong people or evil people. They are all victims. That is not the kind of order which human reason and human morality coming together with human reason could tolerate. We need to take over the world under different management, human management. Well, if you add these three elements which are illustrated by these three dates, then you have roughly the characteristics of the roots in which of the present situation. Well, all three failed. Sovereignty, territorial sovereignty, is now an illusion. Even the most powerful governments cannot really seriously maintain that it is in their possession, apart from some crazy outcasts like North Korea, for example, but the normal politicians acting on political scene wouldn't maintain that. Even the usurpers of power in Burma had to resign at some point their pretense to full independence from the outside world. So sovereignty in one place is inachievable. So the territoriality of sovereignty is inachievable. We are all now dependent on each other. Dependency is already global. The trouble is, however, that all instruments of collective action which we have at our disposal are local. There is a distance, discrepancy, a gap, a hiatus between the two. I would suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that this is the major problem of our times. I'm not a prophet, I am not engaged in prophesizing, and I have no skills of prophesizing. Sociology doesn't teach you to be a prophet. Sociology teaches you how to explain everything, providing it already happened, but not to predict the future. And if somebody has the pretense that he or she is able to predict what's going to happen, must take his inspiration and his courage not from sociology. So I'm not a prophet, but one can roughly visualize what will be the problems with which people will be engaged in ferocious, determined attempts to resolve, not deciding in advance what their resolution will be, that is absolutely impossible, but knowing what will occupy them, what will be their preoccupation in the current century. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the major preoccupation of the 21st century, preoccupation in whose service you will probably spend most of your life, will be the question of remarrying power and politics. Remarrying power and politics. They are now living in divorce, and that's a disaster. They need to be remarried. Now, how? Where? What is the new household where they can cohabit? So the possibilities are immense. There are an enormous amount of them. No one particularly convincing, and no one particularly free from unpleasant side effects. About raising politics to the level of the globe, Karl Jaspers already expressed his view shortly after the Second World War. He called the world government a nightmare. A nightmare, and I agree with him. The argument for world government being a nightmare is very simple. If there is one government for the whole globe, then there is nowhere to escape. And escape is the last resort when things are getting really hard. No, but seriously, it is not likely that something like world government, in our present understanding, we speak about world government imagining our familiar government, be it Polish government, British, German, or whatever, only bigger, extended, stretched to the level of globality. But it can't be like that. It can't be like that. We need global equivalents of the institutions which assure the articulation and culmination of public opinion, of human desires, of human values. But they cannot be constructed after the pattern of parliament. Parliaments which we have today are made to the measure to serve the nation state. They can't be extended. And the same applies to other institutions of the three-partite division of power of which Montesquieu already spoke. Reinhard Kozelek, the great historian of ideas, we had discussion at one point about the influence of the French philosophers of Enlightenment on the sins committed by French Revolution. I was of opinion, which I expressed at the time, that they couldn't be held responsible because they didn't have, they didn't witness the new realities which were created only at the moment of French Revolution and after that. But Kozelek told me I am wrong, and he was right, obviously, because he said that not only that they didn't witness personally the realities changed by the French Revolution, but they couldn't even imagine such a thing because they lacked the concept with which to describe, with which to articulate the idea of a nation state after the French Revolution. For example, they didn't have the idea of representative democracy to start with. That's one example. We don't have even the concept. Concepts will be born together with actions. They will emerge in the course of action. The point which was made a few weeks ago by Richard Sennett, one of the cleverest and wisest living sociologists, that, the notion in which we operate, the idea of rules, idea of proper, improper, and so on, they don't precede the actions which we take, but emerge in the course of it. But something must be done, not on global level. Well, I think that's a hypothesis. I'm not sticking to it if you don't agree. But I believe that the level of nation state is probably the less promising. The restitution of the marriage of power and politics at the level of nation state it seems to be very unlikely. There is a third level, however, the level of local community. The level of local community in which is, I think, phenomenon ever more striking and taking place simultaneously in very distant places of the planet, that in the same way as the distances, geographical distances, because of the new developments, loses their significance, they also acquire their meaning, new meaning, meaning for inhabitants, the little homeland, so to speak, the ability to create something like cooperative of inhabitants residing in a particular places. Now, there are movements like that. There is a slow food movement in Italy, also expanding into città, slow urban centers, urban places in which people live slowly, enjoyably, not necessarily engaged in the rat race, not necessarily running after the latest novelty supplied by the consumerist market, not queuing all night in front of the shop because the next morning they will start selling iPhones 5 instead of iPhones 4. Changing the rhythm of life in local initiative which so far somehow did not find the way of developing solidary links with other similar initiatives. Another development, some people attach quite a lot of hope to it because other hopes failed, internet democracy, sending being engaged in a political struggle by sending 500 Twitters in 1 hour, or creating 500 friends, strong network in 1 day, and so on. Well, so far there is very little evidence, particularly firm evidence, that really internet is a unquestionable.
And in UK scheint klar zu sein, dass Organisationen das auch tun. Gesellschaft, Organisation und Individuum. Das ist also das vierte Merkmal von Leadership, ein kontinuierlicher Prozess zur integren Charakterbildung. Und ich möchte nun zum letzten Punkt kommen, nämlich, dass dies alles in einer Welt sich abspielt, in der wir mit verschiedenen Kulturen gleichzeitig Beziehungen haben und gleichzeitig umgehen müssen, das, was wir Transkulturalität nennen. Transkulturalität ist nicht Interkulturalität und ist auch nicht Multikulturalität, weil Transkulturalität etwas tut, was mir sehr wichtig zu sein scheint, nämlich das, was wir gemeinsam haben, zu betonen und nicht die Differenz. Interkulturalität, Diversity Management setzt darauf, die Differenzen herauszufinden, um sie zu beseitigen, sie damit aber gleichzeitig auch bestätigt. Und ich glaube, wir müssen mehr daran arbeiten und investieren, was das Gemeinsame ist. Es gibt in China eine interessante Bewegung, was dieses Thema angeht, nicht nur ein konfuzianisches Unternehmertum, sondern das Bemerkenswerte dieses konfuzianischen Unternehmertums ist es, dass sie ihre Zuständigkeit für Cultural China sehen. Das ist der Begriff. Cultural China ist nicht die Volksrepublik China, sondern Cultural China. Vietnam, Malaysia und so weiter. Die Gemeinsamkeit all dieser Völker und Kulturen wird hier hervorgehoben. Und ich glaube, es ist ja schon erwähnt worden, in dieser Welt der Vielfalt ist es nicht mehr angemessen, Containermentalitäten hochzuhalten und die Bereitschaft zum gleichberechtigten Austausch muss gegeben sein. Allerdings, denke ich, sind Hochschulen fast exemplarische transkulturelle Räume und vielleicht sollte man dies etwas mehr in den Vordergrund stellen. Manager müssen mit diesen Dingen ebenfalls umgehen können. Transkulturalität als einen Bestandteil, die verschiedenen Ressourcen weltweit zu integrieren, wird an Bedeutung gewinnen. Und wir werden uns darauf einstellen müssen, auch Forschung auf dem Gebiet zu betreiben. Gibt es Werte, die allen Zivilisationen gemeinsam sind? Hans Küng und Klaus Leisinger haben dazu ein Manifest globales Wirtschaftsethos vorgeschlagen, an dem ich mitgewirkt habe, in dem so etwas probiert wird. Aber auch die 7 Werte und Prinzipien, die ich eben aus der UN erwähnt habe, gehören in diese Reihe. Hier stehen wir ganz am Anfang und man kann dort positiv sein, negativ sein. Aber eins sollte man wissen, eine weltweite Diskussion darüber, was wir gemeinsam haben, ist nicht so einfach, wie sich das anhört. Ethik basiert darauf, dass wir Emotionen freisetzen, die wir in Face-to-Face-Gesellschaften freisetzen können, weil wir die Menschen häufig treffen. Vielleicht auch in Nationalstaaten, aber schon in Europa wird es schwierig, was wir gemeinsam haben und was wir einander schuldig sind und was für Emotionen wir eigentlich für unsere Nachbarn aufbringen. Und das Ganze weltweit, noch abstrakter, noch weiter weg. Und dennoch ist es so, dass wir in jeder Chibo-Filiale Kaffee aus fairem Anbau kaufen, der in einem hochkomplexen Prozess hergestellt wurde, deren Produzenten wir eigentlich nicht kennen. Das müssen Unternehmen organisieren und auch das, glaube ich, ist ein wesentlicher Bestandteil von Leadership Excellence. Lassen Sie mich zusammenfassen. Leadership Excellence heißt, ich muss die Ressourcen